In 1949, the legendary naturalist and conservationist Aldo Leopold published a book, A Sand County Almanac, parts of which detail Leopold's efforts to rehabilitate a rundown central Wisconsin farm, land that had been abused for over 100 years. In that book, Leopold outlined what he called the land ethic, something that's stuck with conservationists ever since. Over 50 years later, Scott Freeman and his family bought a parcel of land along Tarbu Creek, a degraded salmon spawning stream on Washington's Olympic Peninsula, and they expressed Leopold's land ethic through their own efforts to restore what generations of abuse had caused. The restoration is chronicled in the new book, Saving Tarbu Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. Scott Freeman is an evolutionary biologist and teaches in the biology department at the University of Washington, and he joins us by phone this morning. Good morning, Scott.
Morning, John. Good to be here.
So, like you, I read your biography. Like you, I grew up in Wisconsin, and Aldo Leopold was one of those legendary figures that we learned about in grade school, and A Sand County Almanac was a very, very important book for me growing up as well. And as I read your book, both Aldo Leopold and his book, A Sand County Almanac, seem to be standing in the background all the time. But your connection to him just goes beyond a shared conservation ethic, doesn't it?
That's right. My wife is his granddaughter, and my boys, we have two boys, and they've joined us in this work you mentioned on Tarbu Creek, working on the salmon stream and planting trees, and they are the fourth generation of Leopolds to do this kind of work, making a connection with the land.
So can you describe Aldo Leopold's land ethic and how it's inspired you?
Yeah, it's one of those most really good ideas. It's very simple. What Leopold said, his ethic, is that he sort of looked at human beings from the dawn of time and said, what have we really cared about? How have we extended our ethical behavior? And he said, well, we start out just caring about ourselves or our immediate family, offspring and so forth. And then he said, as civilization progressed and our ideas matured, we started to say, no, we should care about and extend ethical behavior to our immediate community. And then it was a state or a nation, and then community of nations, or the all human beings, the family of man. And then he said the land ethic, the essence of this is now we need to extend it beyond our own species to nature, to the natural world and the environment, and just treat the natural world the way a good person treats another good person. This is something we take care of. This is something we invest in and nurture. So again, a very, very simple idea, but as you mentioned, really powerful.
And that land ethic has quite a tradition in Judeo-Christian religious practice as well, doesn't it?
It does. In the New Testament and the Gospels, for example, there's a very strong tradition of stewardship of creation. And so, yeah, there's a very strong, and this is something that goes through sort of certainly Native American traditions, First Nations practice, and religious traditions around the world, from Buddhist to Taoism to Hindu, of just that the natural world is important. It's an expression of who we are.
So, Scott Freeman, how did you come to own this property on Tarbu Creek in the Olympic Peninsula?
Well, my wife Susan and I actually met at the Leopold Shack, that farm that you mentioned in central Wisconsin that had been beat up and that the family had started to restore in 1935. And when we met there in 1980, it was actually gorgeous. The trees that they planted back in the Depression had grown up and the prairies were blooming, and it was a fabulous place. And Susan and I both had fellowships to work there for the summer doing projects. And when we got together and later started a family, we always dreamed about, life took us out to the Pacific Northwest, and we always dreamed about, gosh, it would be wonderful if we could do a project like this of our own as a family and with friends and like-minded people. And in 2004, we found this spot you mentioned called Tarbu Creek.
And was it something you were specifically looking for? Did it land in your lap?
When we decided we could pull this off, we were looking for a little spot, and we really contacted conservation groups around our home in Seattle that would be accessible, and we said, we're looking for a project, and we are actually looking for land that's been beat up. We want to help make things better here. And so we looked at a variety of areas, and this the Taribou Creek project just really captured our imagination. There was a very nascent, just getting started effort to work on the entire watershed, and there was this little 17-acre parcel that had the most beat up, most degraded, most almost discouraging section of this creek. But we had this idea that, you know, there are a bunch of people who were really concerned about making this place better, and we could play a part.
So can you draw us a picture of the property as you found it originally?
Yes. It was such a mess. When we first visited there, I mean, Susan and I have done a lot of everything from converting old houses to, you know, helping friends who've been in trouble. We've done a lot of projects, and including land restoration, but this one was imposing. The creek had been ditched, so this area was converted to agriculture, the watershed, the lowlands, 120 years ago, but the soils are very poor, so the farms had failed, most of them back in the 1960s. So this land had just been left abandoned, basically, for almost 50 years. And when we got to the creek, this ditch was still intact. And I'll never forget, we were out there with a friend on our first visit, and she climbed down into the ditch and couldn't see out. It was the creek and she were 6 feet under. So terrible erosion was going on. And in most of the other sections, it was just covered with Himalayan blackberry, if your listeners are familiar with that.
Oh, yes, we are.
Notorious, thorny, invasive, and another really famous bad actor called reed canary grass. So, yeah, it was a ferocious mess.
The book is Saving Taribou Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. Scott Freeman is in the biology department at the University of Washington. He was part of the project, he and his family. He's also the author of this new book. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. And we're going to hear more about Taribou Creek and what it looks like now and how it all worked as we return with Scott Freeman in just a moment. It's the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter in today for Jeffrey Riley. And in this hour, we're talking with Scott Freeman. He's the author of a new book, Saving Taribou Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. It describes he and his family's efforts to rehabilitate land on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. Scott, just before the break, you had left us standing in the middle of a 6-foot-deep ditch, and this was originally a salmon stream. What did you do with this drainage ditch?
We got to work, and this was a partnership with a bunch of people in the community who had been looking at this creek and thinking that this would be a great place to try to bring back to some sort of health. So there's a group called Northwest Watershed Institute that had a little grant to pay for a guy named Bob Harrison, who makes most of his living, most of his year, digging basements with an excavator, but he's a salmon fisherman. So during late summer, when it's permitted, he does a lot of salmon stream restoration work. And so he brought his machines over, and the first thing we did in 2004 is that Bob went in and got the stream out of the ditch. So he dug a new channel that was meandering, lots of S-curves, and he put a lot of down timber in it, waste stuff from local logging operations. And he basically, as he said, I just make the bones of the creek. I give it good bones. And then he says that the stream will make itself over time. So he got it into the new channel, and, you know, friends and family were there helping. Sue's dad, who was in his 80s, this is a guy who had planted trees with his mom and dad in the 30s, and he was there helping us out as this excavator was trundling back and forth, getting this creek into better shape. And then that winter, hundreds of school kids and their moms and dads came out, and we had tons of planting parties with friends, and we started planting trees. And that work continues. We'll probably be planting trees and shrubs out there to the day we die.
So did your excavator have anything to go on? Were there indications of where the creek had once been that he could follow?
Yeah, you could find sort of traces of it. So this area had been pastured for years. So you could find traces of the old channel. And so the folks from Northwest Watershed Institute actually designed it. You know, they make blueprints of what these salmon streams, these restoration areas are going to look like. And it passes permitting and inspection and so forth. So it really is sort of engineered, and they figure out, well, if we get these types of rains that we did 3 or 5 years ago, where's the water going to go when it floods? And so it's designed and actually very carefully done to maximize the habitat for the fish.
So once the stream was dug, or re-meandered, as you say in the book, and he gave the bones to the stream, the water started channeling in there. There was down timber. There were new rocks, etc. Did you see the salmon return soon?
Yeah, there was one. Well, it took a few years because another key thing is that tree planting I mentioned and the salmon stream, for it to really be what the biologists call a high-functioning salmon stream, you need trees that are dropping organic material that creates food for the babies and keeps the water cool. And the riffles develop over time as there's sediment and gravel gets transported. So that took a few years, but yeah, we started to see the runs start to come back. There were if your listeners know, there were some chum and coho salmon still in the stream. The runs a bit, you know, as normal, they go up and down over time, but we are seeing the runs come back. Nothing like what we've heard from folks who grew up in the area, like what it was like back in the day. Although occasionally we've seen a big run since the restoration started. So the fish are coming back, and there's one species. There used to be steelhead in the creek. Those are sea run rainbow trout, one of the most admired salmon species in our region. And they used to be in the creek. We haven't seen them come back. We go out. They would nest, and they would come into the creek in March typically. So we always check, just hoping that some wandering steelhead will come back and repopulate Tarbu Creek.
Now, you mentioned in the book that the watershed, the Tarbu Creek watershed itself, was at one point in danger of being subdivided into rural lots for vacation homes and hobby farms. Why didn't that happen? And can you describe to us what the rest of the watershed looks like?
Well, there are the creek flows into two little bays called Daybob Bay, and then that opens up into another body of water in the Pacific called Daybob Bay. And the water quality in these bays, these estuaries, is so good that it's one of the few areas in our state where commercial operations can grow oysters. So the water quality is really pristine. So that was a huge value. People said, we've got something special here. It's considered one of the best two or three estuaries left in the whole Puget Sound Basin. So people recognized the value of this area, and there'd been a history of if people were logging on slopes that were really steep, there'd been some slides and some bad erosion problems that were causing problems in these bays. And as I said, as we said, the creek was in rough shape. So all of this restoration area was from the get-go, was really focused on the watershed as a whole, not just bits and pieces. And 15 years later, a lot of those steep slopes, most of those steep slopes have been protected now, so they won't be logged, and we'll solve those slide problems. And a lot of the private landowners along the bay have put conservation easements on their property, so it won't be subdivided and developed. We've been able to buy some forest land, so we've actually started a little sustainable forestry company that our family is working in, and avoided that kind of subdivision that you mentioned.
We're talking with Scott Freeman. He is in the biology department at the University of Washington and is the author of a new book, Saving Tarbu Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. What do you think about this? Maybe you have some experience rehabilitating land that you own. You can join the conversation this morning with Scott Freeman at 800-838-3760, or just shoot us an email. jx@jeffnet.org is our email address. Scott, getting back to the salmon, they obviously play a key role in your book and in your watershed and the Tarbu Creek ecosystem itself. You write in the book that you've concluded that the old ways of managing salmon runs have failed. And can you tell us how, in your opinion, they failed and maybe what lessons you've drawn from Tarboo Creek about how they should be managed?
Well, I'm just actually reading a book about the history of salmon exploitation in British Columbia, and it's wherever you read about Atlantic salmon getting wiped out in Scandinavia and Northern Europe or on the eastern seaboard of the U.S. and what used to be just a fantastic fishery. Those old ways of just the resources out there, let's go grab as much as we can, as fast as we can, they have failed. In most of the geography of salmon country, the runs are a tiny fraction of what they used to be. And so we've lost just a source of abundant, cheap, delicious protein that was going to be really hard to recover. And so, you know, a lot of people care, and a lot of people are thinking about how to do this. I've seen proposals as radical as, let's go back to what the First Nations were doing when European settlers first arrived, and manage these streams, these populations, stream by stream, where we can really monitor things in a precise way year after year and make good decisions about managing fish populations for the long term.
So your land is not just the stream. You also have a lot of woodlands on your land. Can you tell us about your restoration efforts on the wooded part of your property?
Yeah, we were able to purchase, we now have a little over 200 acres of working forest land. About half of that are older stands. We actually have some trees that are 110 years old. They're just massive Doug firs. They're just stately old grandparents. And then we have some smaller areas, about 80, 90 acres, that are more recent. We're clear cut within the last 10 to 20 years, and those we're managing very aggressively. We're out there thinning and pruning and working on a model where we can produce really high quality wood products out of the Pacific Northwest off of a small family operation. And that's been a lot of fun to learn about some forestry techniques and think about how can we really manage this little place to be productive and produce some beautiful things for the community to use.
Did you have forestry background when you went into this?
No, I didn't. I'd always done some forest management in sort of a casual way back from college days, but this is our first chance to really read up and put in practice and talk to a bunch of foresters. And there's a lot of work going on in the Pacific Northwest from Northern California up into BC and Alaska with small forest landowners just exchanging information and ideas and drawing on experts and thinking about how we might sort of remodel forestry, you know, the industrial scale forests and producing 2x4s and plywood. That'll always go on. But there's another sort of effort going on of these small forest landowners managing lands to produce posts and beams and furniture wood and sort of higher quality products.
So, Scott, one of the emotional challenges of habitat restoration is that you're probably not likely to see the results of many of your efforts. And as you describe in the book, you start planning your tree planting, for example, and you have to make an educated guess about what the climatic conditions will be around Tarboo Creek in, say, 100 years. And that means trying to anticipate climate change. Can you walk us through the process that you describe it in great detail in the book, but can you walk us through it briefly and what you ultimately decided?
Yeah, we just got our plant order last week and are planting our planting days for this planting season right now. And it is a challenge. The summers, as predicted back from the 20 years ago or more, summers are getting drier here and fire danger is going up and winters are getting wetter. So the climate is changing before our eyes, and we have to think about what trees are gonna work. So if the climate change projections, if sort of present trends continue with fossil fuel use and temperature change, we would need to be planting trees that now are native to Northern California and Southern Oregon for our grandchildren or great-grandchildren to see three trees thriving. And the conundrum we're in is that the climate hasn't changed that much yet for those trees to really do well. And so, you know, our philosophy has been, well, we've got to plant trees for the future. Some of these trees can live 500, even 1,000 years on the Olympic Peninsula. So we are thinking very long term. And yet we don't know what's going to go on with climate. So we basically, our philosophy is we're going to plant trees that are adapted to the climate we've got over the next decade or so. And just we're hoping and working that as a community and as a species, human beings will sort of wake up and decide that we need to change what we're doing here and do something about climate change that will tamp down those really extreme predictions.
You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. My guest is Scott Freeman. He is the author of a new book, Saving Taribou Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land, a description of not just how, but why they undertook a major rehabilitation project on land on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. You can join the conversation here by calling us at 800-838-3760 or send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. I'm going to take a call from Bill in Eugene. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate what your guest and his family's doing, man. It's like I can't believe how much he's doing. And I have a really depressing thing I heard on your station or an NPR station in like the last 2 months that they've done studies up and down the total West Coast and East Coast of the United States, and they find all shellfish, you know, have in their flesh super, super minute small pieces of plastic, which is supposedly the curse of our oceans. And I just wondered what your guest thinks of this, if it's true or how it's going to affect us, and should we even eat shellfish anymore, and how it'll get into our bodies. And I'm kind of concerned because I love shellfish and I love the environment growing it, you know. Thank you.
Scott, comments on that?
Yeah, the phenomenon, I first started to hear about this in the scientific literature just a few years ago. Your caller is correct. This is a brand new issue that people are becoming aware of. But what's happening is that plastics that make their way into the ocean through whatever means are getting beat up, you know, physically broken apart, and eventually there are these little micro particles that can be ingested by even tiny little organisms. And then in the case of shellfish that are screening debris out of the ocean, they'll accumulate some of these plastics. I haven't seen any literature on this posing a danger to humans for consumption, but, you know, certainly something we'll want to track over time. But it is another issue that's just sort of creating awareness in the scientific community and people who eat seafood and are concerned about their health issues. So it's certainly something to watch that microplastics are going to be an issue for us to deal with.
So you plant lots and lots of trees on the property, and as you described the property, when you found it, there was a meadow that sort of surrounded that ditch that used to be Taribou Creek. How did you know that meadow wanted to be a forest again?
Well, the entire area, you can go back to the land survey records, and that when the government was first laying out sections and townships across North America, and the surveyors would make records on what the plant life was like. And so a friend of ours went back and read those and said, oh, this was mostly Sitka spruce and western red cedar. They called it a bottom, really wet soils. So we said, well, and we could see stumps that were left over from the old growth days and get an idea of what kind of trees were around. So that was one of the original ideas that told us what sort of suite of trees should be growing out here. But reforesting an old pasture is really hard. My son ran across a paper in the Olympic National Park, which has been a national park, so, you know, really strongly protected for over 100 years. There are pastures that were in holdings in the park that were abandoned well over 100 years ago, and they have yet to reforest. And they've had tree seeds raining down on them for decades after decades after decades, but that grass sod is really tough. So when we went out to try to reforest these derelict pastures, it's been a struggle in some cases. We have spots where the trees just dig in and take off, and little saplings we planted 10, 15 years ago now are 20, 30 feet high and shooting up 3 to 5 feet a year. So that's been wonderfully satisfying. But other areas where it's just been a struggle to get these samplings to take hold.
So did you have any notable failures in the project so far?
Oh, yeah. You always have. Yeah, that's for sure. But, you know, it's like in life. It's not whether you get knocked down. It's whether you get back up. And that's true of a restoration project as well. So you learn as you go, and you learn by making mistakes and talking to people who have done this before. That a lot of times we would plant tree species in one area thinking, oh, this will be just perfect. You know, look at this gentle slope, and it should be well-drained, and we'll put these species out there, and 2 years later, they've all drowned because it's a lot wetter than you thought, and you have to completely switch what you were doing. So, that kind of stuff goes on all the time.
And how about in the stream itself?
Well, the big deal there is that one of the animals that was missing in the watershed when this whole project got started were beavers. And after a few years, they showed back up, which... is actually a good thing for salmon biologists. There's nothing better for salmon habitat than to have a bunch of beaver dams and ponds and wetlands. The salmon babies just love that sort of place. But when they first started showing up, they started nipping all of our little trees, so we knew we had a problem on our hands.
Scott Freeman's the author of Saving Tarboo Creek, and we're going to be spending some time, I guess, with beavers and talking more about he and his family and their efforts to heal the land in Tarboo Creek in the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. We'll be back with Scott Freeman in just a moment here on the Jefferson Exchange. Our final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm John Baxter in for Jeffrey Riley, and our guest today is Scott Freeman. He teaches in the biology department at the University of Washington and is the author of a new book, Saving Tarboo Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. And before the break, Scott, we were talking about the stream and the beavers show up, and it's kind of a problem. Your friends, in fact, some friends say, hey, you really should get rid of them, but you decided not to.
We decided not to, yeah. So, because we did understand that the work they would be doing, dams and ponding and so forth, would make for really good salmon habitat. And what happens is that if they dam a stream, the adults, when they come back to breed, they will jump it. We've watched them. They'll flop themselves, throw themselves up on the dam and actually just flop over it. Or if it's been raining and it's higher water and flooding a little bit, they'll just swim around it. So the adults can cope with the dams. And then the babies, when they float down from the nesting areas upstream, they love to spend, they'll be in the creek for about a year getting bigger before they go out, back out into the ocean. But they love beaver ponds. The water's slow, so they're not spending a lot of energy fighting a current. And there's lots of food to eat, lots of insects, lots of organic debris. So we wanted beavers there, but as I mentioned before the break, they were eating our trees. And to have a good salmon stream, you also need a lot of big trees. So we started experimenting with ways to protect the saplings so that we could have beavers and trees, and it took a lot of doing and a lot of failures where we thought, oh, no, this tree is just going to be fine. The beavers won't possibly get over this wire. And they would come down and just crush our chicken wire down to the ground and eat that tree. So after a lot of experimentation and trial and error, and mostly error, we do have a system now where we use 4-foot, 1-inch mesh poultry netting and stick a couple bamboo rods or 1x2s to make it stiff. And that's been able to protect all the trees that we really need to keep growing near the stream.
I want to get back to the Leopold family. Your wife, Susan, is Aldo Leopold's granddaughter, and she provided the illustrations for your book. But another Leopold shows up quite frequently in your book, and that's Carl Leopold. Tell us about him.
Carl is Susan's dad, and I think his mom and dad started their project, their restoration project in Wisconsin, when he was about 16, 17, something like that. It was in the teeth of the Depression. And so he worked there with his family, and again, they planted trees and brought prairie plants back. And then when he was off to college. I think he was a freshman. Pearl Harbor got bombed, and the next week he enlisted in the Marines and spent 4 years in the Pacific as an artillery officer. Came back to the States after the war and started a career, but planted trees all his life, and as I mentioned, was part of our Taru Creek project from day one. And he just loved what we were doing out there. I'll never forget when we were walking through our little plantings when the trees were just babies. And, you know, we walked through in the evening and just check on how the trees were doing and enjoying the family time together. And one time he just said sort of to himself, I overheard him, and he said, "This is just what we did 60 years ago. It's just what we did." So he was one of the people just loved Carl Leopold. He was a friend to everyone, planted trees everywhere he lived over his life. And so he was part of the inspiration for why we do what we do. And when we were able to buy some working forest land and get that project started, we named it Carl's Forest after him.
And your working forest continues today. One of the things that you mentioned in your book is that you don't see, as you're managing a working forest, you don't see the dichotomy that we often read in the media of jobs versus the environment. That's to you a false dichotomy, isn't it?
In my mind, yes. And almost always, you know, we do love dichotomies. We like to think politically things are left or right, or issues are black and white, and it is trees in the environment versus the economy. But really, when things are working well, we're working with ands. So managing land in a way that's both productive and helping people support themselves and start businesses and grow their families, and taking care of the soils and water so that we leave a legacy that those kids and their grandkids are going to enjoy. It's been really rewarding to us to see, just in our little county near Taru Creek, there have been, just over the past 10, 15 years, this little movement of 20-somethings coming out and starting little agricultural businesses, cideries and orchards and market gardens and meat production, and doing very well. These are really smart, thoughtful people who want to take care of this place they're calling home. So, I don't see the ores, and we see the same thing in the woods, that the big commercial companies, that there's a role for them in producing commodity wood products, and a role for small forest landowners like us, you know, doing more labor-intensive forestry and producing higher quality products.
The topic today is Healing the Land. We're talking with Scott Freeman, the author of Saving Taru Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land, property that they own on Washington's Olympic Peninsula. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760. Or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Scott, I wanted to ask you about something that is not in your book, and that is there's very little mention of your neighbors. You mentioned at the beginning of the program that there was a fair amount of watershed restoration going on already on the Taru Creek drainage. But have you encountered neighbors that just don't agree with what you're doing or don't understand it?
The only negative, so the short answer is mostly no. There's one sort of standing joke in the watershed when these restoration projects have gone along the creek with the remeandering and to restore the stream course. One of the things you do is you put in dead wood. You put in snags, and so you plant these dead trunks in the ground to serve as wildlife trees. And some of the neighbors say, you know, it's pretty ugly until the rest of the little trees grow up and around, and there have been some comments about that. But other than that, people have been really supportive. A lot of the neighbors have put conservation easements on their portion of the creek or encouraged groups if there's money to remeander their part of the creek, or taken part in the planting program. So I think the community's been really supportive.
So we talked about the neighbors. What advice would you give to someone who maybe owns a plot of land and sees the need to heal it or wants to investigate that more? Where do they start? You obviously have a background in biology. You have the Leopold family tradition. as well. But somebody like myself, for example, who has a piece of property and says, you know, what do I do with this? Where do we start?
Yeah, great question. It's been really encouraging to see little projects like you're talking about happening all over the place. And so there's, you don't have to look too hard to find people who are doing projects in your neighborhood and that you can learn from. So, and that's my often my first piece of advice is find a group of people to do this with. You know, you can start with your immediate friends and family, but pretty soon the ripples go out. And as I said, we've had school kids coming out to plant trees at our place, and we're hearing from those school kids now that 10, 15 years later, they'll come back to see their trees and watch them grow up. So I would really encourage people to think about that kind of broader community involvement. It just makes it a lot more fun. And in terms of expertise, you can, again, find people in the community who have done some projects in the area. Often they're land trusts or nature conservancy programs or county or state agencies where people are doing some things, so you can pick up some tips.
We're talking with Scott Freeman. He's the author of Saving Tarboo Creek, one family's efforts to heal a piece of property that they own on Tarboo Creek in the Olympic Peninsula in Washington. And Scott, your book ends with a sort of a four-part prescription for changing the way we see the world. And it really does extend back to Aldo Leopold's land ethic. Can you describe that four-part process to us?
Yeah, I will. There's my favorite quote from Leopold's writing is he said, there are two things that interest me, the connection of people to each other and the connection of people to the land. And that's something that's been very near and dear to everyone in our family, is that that's really what our lives are about, is connections with each other and connections to the land. And the sort of, when I try to boil this down, I say, well, what does it really mean to someone to practice that? I came up with these sort of four things to think about, and the first one is that I think we really need to be engaged. This is not something you just talk about or read about. It's something you do, that you do make an effort to grow a little bit of your own food or hunt or fish or plant trees somewhere or work on a coastline that's been beat up. So that's the first thing, is to be active. And then the second one, I advise I call it being present, and that's gotten difficult. You know, our phones are jingling in our pockets constantly, and things are going on, and it's really hard to, but I think necessary to turn the phone off once in a while and actually take a deep breath or two and sit on a stump and watch the moon or watch a deer go by instead of watching a video of it and really experience your life. So that's what I call being present. And then the third sort of attitude is, I call it being real. And that's more about, again, something that's very difficult for us now in our culture. We're just bombarded with this consumer culture of be happier and buy more stuff. And that your self-worth, your value as a human being is about how big your car is or how big your house is or how fancy your vacation was. And at some point, you have to say, you know what? That's really not what's where I live and breathe. That's really not what's important to me. And that's what I call being real. It's just essentially, it's loving yourself for who you are and what you stand for and what you believe in. That's a really important thing, I think, to keep present in your life. And then the last thing is more of a practical thing. I call it just being simple. And that's sort of if you accept yourself and love yourself, and then you're happy just with the sort of your what you do consume and how you run your life, of being simple instead of trying to make things complicated or again focus your life around how much you're buying. So I just tried to think through what's been important to us as a family and to friends that we admire and boil it down to those four simple ideas for people to think about.
Scott Freeman is our guest. He's the author of Saving Tarboo Creek, a new book about a family's efforts to heal the land that they own on the Olympic Peninsula. Scott, I'm going to commit a real sin here for interviewers and ask about the very end of your book, because it ends with a plea. Do you want to share that with us?
Yeah, I will. This is partly out of my teaching. I teach biology to 17, 18, 19-year-olds. And we go in the course that I teach a lot, we go through data on human population growth and climate change and that there's a mass extinction underway. And it can be discouraging, especially to young people or to people, you know, at my age who care about young people and about the future of the world. And so I guess my message at the end is that we do need to change what we're doing, and probably in a hurry. And there's a lot of joy in making that change and a lot of reward of planting a tree or being out with friends and experiencing wildlife and nature. It's a better life to me. And as I say at the end, the old ways, the you know, buy more stuff, let an advertiser tell you who you should be, I think those ways have failed. It's gotten us to the point where we're facing the environmental crisis we are, and that we need new ways. And that plea that I end the book with is just to band together as a community and for us all to pitch in and look for a new way.
And you mentioned in the book, we're just about out of time here, but I wanted to touch on this last piece that you mentioned in the book, and that's the entire field of restoration ecology, because that's really what you're talking about here on Taribo Creek. That field seems to be really growing, and that must give you some optimism.
Yes, because I was when I was in college and first starting to do projects, it was a new word. It was a new idea. And as you mentioned, there's a whole scientific field now and tons of volunteers. And it's global. For example, Wangari Maathai, who started her work in Kenya, tree planting projects, she called the Green Belt Movement, won the Nobel Prize. So the sort of international and global implications are real.
Scott Freeman is the author of Saving Taribo Creek, a new book about his family's quest to heal the land. Scott teaches at the University of Washington. We really appreciate you spending time with us today here on the Jefferson Exchange, Scott.
John, this was a lot of fun. Thank you.